Mrs. Eleanor Swint continuing an interview with Jack Havard on September 5th, 1991. No, you certainly are not. Not at all. Okay. So you, what about, well, you, was there anything significant about your graduation or?
Well, other than I got high honors.
You did, yeah.
I mentioned that.
You did,
And I was off to work. Each graduation before I didn't stay for the ceremonies.
But I'll
jump ahead a little while we're talking about this. When I got the 6 years after graduation, when I got my professional degree, I was then works manager at Heath, Montana for U.S. Gypsum, and I decided to go to commencement exercise, and I had met Faith, who was in Chicago on a nursing program, and I asked her if she could come up and join me in the commencement ceremonies and after for a while.
This is at Madison.
This is at Madison, and her uncle was president of the University of Wisconsin, and she had lived in the presidential manse for a couple of years before she felt an urge to, well, she really, her first urge was to be a missionary nurse. And there's a story behind how she got that, but I'll leave that for some other time. But anyway, I did go back in June of 42, 7 years after I graduated, in June of 42, and she couldn't get up in time for the actual exercises in the morning. So I walked across the platform and got my diploma from her uncle. Then I went down, met her at the train, and then she took us out. We had a rental car, we drove out to the presidential manse where I met her uncle and her aunt, and people were gathered there for that the afternoon of that commencement, which was very pleasant indeed.
Was her uncle's name?
Dykstra. D-Y-K-S-T-R-A, Clarence Dykstra. So that was a delightful occasion.
Yes. Made up for some of the ones.
We got on the train together, went back to Chicago, and she went back into the nursing program, and I got on a train and went back to Montana.
How did you meet Faith? We're jumping ahead, I know, but...
Yeah, we're really jumping ahead.
Would you rather wait till?
Yeah, I think it all fits together.
All right. I did want to ask, when did you join AIME? Was that at
immediately Madison? After I got out of college, 1935.
As a junior
member.
And then that was the beginning of a long, successful ladder in that association, too.
Well, it was also a fine example of what SME and AIME could do for people, because when I landed at this job in Oklahoma, this little town called Southard, S-O-U-T-H-A-R-D, company town, I was the only engineer at the facility.
Really?
And I was a long way from any meetings, But I got the magazine and technical papers, and I bought books, and SME was a great educator, mm-hmm. and fulfilled one of its roles very completely with me, and that is taking care of the lonely engineer who was a long way from anywhere, you know.
Keeping him in touch with his profession.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And advances in the profession.
Mm-hmm.
So it really was helpful.
Now the magazine was Mining Engineering.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The person, you didn't go in there to assist or relieve another engineer?
There had been I was hired to be, this is a mighty title for a small job.
Uh-huh.
I was hired to be superintendent of mines and quarries for this plant. My predecessor had left several months before, and there had been a gap in there.
So that's kind of hard to go in with nobody to show you the ropes.
Yeah, it was kind of a cool beginning, but the works manager was a very fine man and a very intelligent man, and he put me through a course of training. He had me work in the laboratory testing, and he had me work as a plant engineer, doing all kinds of chores for the master mechanic, you know. I got a thorough indoctrination in that plant from June until December, when he finally let me take over as superintendent of mines and quarries, the mighty title.
Now he was your superior? He was
the manager of the whole works.
I see.
They call him works manager.
Well, what was there in addition to mines and quarries?
Well, it was an extremely interesting gypsum plant. I couldn't have been sent to a more interesting plant, because the gypsum was extremely high grade, and therefore they could make things there that they couldn't make elsewhere. They had the normal line of building materials, you know, the plasters, and they had a full wallboard plant, sheetrock and rock glass, and the standard gypsum wallboards. But they also produced some unusual products, such as filler for toothpaste and orthopedic plasters that are used, you know, by orthopedists, and pottery plaster, which is used by the pottery industry for making all kinds of pottery dishes and so on, all of which are made on plaster cast. We also made a product called plate glass plaster, which was used by the plate as a bed for polishing plate glass. A process which has become obsolete in recent years, but we had to be particular in the rocks that we chose for these different products, and because of the variety of products, including some dead burn gypsum, it was called Keen Cement.
Dead burn?
Dead burn gypsum was called Keen Cement. Made a very hard, water-resistant plaster. Made the plant very interesting.
Mm-hmm. But you didn't have anything to do with these production.
I just produced things. The gypsum rock that was brought up, but I had to meet the specifications for these different grades. You know.
Mm-hmm.
and it was pretty crude operation by today's standards. We had a drag line that did the stripping. We had we loaded the rock by hand.
Mm.
It was hand selected and hand cleaned.
Mm.
And the men are paid by the ton loaded into 2-ton cars.
Who were your laborers?
They were mostly from Tennessee and Kentucky, that type of person.
Hmm.
And nice people, hardworking. And we had a few key people, like we had foreman, and we had a mine mechanic who was very skilled. The drag line operator was skilled, and so on. I had to do everything. If we were going to extend the railroad, we had a narrow gauge railroad that hauled the rock from the quarries up to the plant for crushing and so on. And anything that required any engineering, and so I was the only one around. And we had a couple of underground mines that we used. One of them provided us a very special kind of rock, and the other one was a hideout in bad weather. This went on.
So you selected different kinds of rock from, did all these different grades come from the same location? Or did you mine at different places?
Different places.
For what you wanted.
And sometimes it was a degree of cleaning you would do on them too.
I see.
It was a beautiful gypsum.
Hmm. Are there any special hazards with gypsum?
No, there is no. It's very benign.
Uh-huh.
And you can breathe in gypsum dust and it doesn't hurt you at all.
Uh-huh. And mining, it isn't particularly dangerous?
No, not at all. It's a soft, white rock. It's really a delightful rock to work with.
Mm-hmm. There's a perlite plant in Grants, isn't, what's perlite?
Well, I'm responsible for that plant.
Are you?
That comes later in the story.
Okay.
Much later.
Okay.
Trying to think of something more interesting.
Well,
of course,
that.
In the process, I had to learn management.
Uh-huh.
Which nobody had ever taught me, you know. In those days, they didn't have management classes.
No.
For mining engineers, you just sent out to manage for yourself, yeah. You know. And I learned a lot. I made mistakes handling people, and
Were there people who resented your coming in?
Well, there were some, I think, that did, you know. But one of the things that helped me was softball. This is a digression, but it's kind of interesting. In that country out there, in fact, throughout Oklahoma and maybe other states nearby,
yeah.
At that time, fast pitch hardball was the game. And there was no TV, and radio was rather limited, and entertainment was limited. And the town softball team was the place where people put their hearts. And so at Southern we had departmental team, and then we had a Southern team. And I made the Southern team, all right. And we traveled around to these nearby towns. I guess in the, they all were in the range of 500 to 1,000 people somewhere, little towns, dirt roads in every direction, you know, impoverished agricultural town.
Mm-hmm.
And playing the evening, playing the softball. And it was just tremendous fun. It was exciting because everybody in town was there cheering, you know. And because I made the softball team right away, that was a great step in being accepted.
Well, now you said fast pitch hardball.
Fast pitch softball.
Softball, okay.
You know, there's fast pitch and slow pitch.
Uh-huh.
But this was the old fast pitch.
What position did you play?
Oh, I played. I played first base and pitched usually one of those.
Pitcher.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But
yeah, that's a good idea.
That was a tremendous help.
Sure.
And so I became friends with mm-hmm. all these people, and they were wonderful people in many respects. They were had come out of the hills of Tennessee and Kentucky mostly.
Mm-hmm.
And
were they miners by background?
No.
No.
They had long English names, you know, Schoonover and I can't think of some of those names, but they and they were delightful people.
Churchgoers?
Yes, there was a preacher in town, and the company supplied his house, and he had a wife and daughter, and he preached every Sunday.
Mm.
And I think he was kind of a Southern Baptist
type. Probably, uh-huh. Dances? Were there dances?
Oh, yeah, yeah. They were nice people. Yeah. Totally intolerant of blacks.
Uh-huh.
You know, no black would dare show up in that community.
No.
But they were a hard-working, decent bunch of people. Aside from that, Billion Prejudice, which didn't mean anything at that time. That was just the way it was.
No.
Nobody thought about it.
All Democrats, I'll bet.
I suppose they were. I don't remember anything much about
politics. Wasn't important.
No, Roosevelt was firmly in the place at that time.
Uh-huh. So you didn't talk politics much.
No. And of course, we could tell. We were a very sensitive gauge of the economics.
Mm-hmm.
And our business kept getting better.
Good.
As during the 3 years I was there.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
good place to start out.
It was a good place to start out and learn the basics of supervision.
Mm. Was there company housing?
All company housing. And it was very simple, but adequate. I think our house was $15 a month.
Now, you were there as a bachelor. Did you board somewhere?
Well, my mother joined me after a few months.
I see.
Went and we fixed up a little house. I have to tell you an incident. Right off the bat, I went into the office and the cashier was a rather nosy man. You tend to get in a place like that. Shortly after I was there, he said, "Jack, you're making $135 a month. We've never started an engineering year at $125 a month. What kind of pull do you have in the main office?" Well, that was news to me. I didn't know that. But I did start $135 a month to save money.
It's a princely salary in those days.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Were there boarding houses?
There was a boarding house. When I got there, I had driven down from Madison. I had 75 cents in my pocket. That was my total worth, plus the Essex Super 6 Speedster and a great box of books in the back of it. So I stayed there 3 years.
Did they have a company bunkhouse or boarding house or something for the single men?
Yes, yes.
Uh-huh.
And when I first arrived there, I was fed because I had a job.
Uh-huh.
I didn't have enough money to pay for more than one meal. You know.
Uh-huh.
They took care of me all right.
Hmm.
Well, after 3 years, I was single, and I had met a very nice girl who was the daughter of a doctor in a nearby town, and we'd gone to shows together and stuff, but there wasn't a spark, and she later married somebody else. And I was just lonely, you know, really. I didn't want to be a single man all my life, and there were no girls in that town. So I resigned and decided to try to get the medicine industry, and I went up to and took my mother dragging along with me, you know, and went up. By this time, I had graduated to a Chevrolet coupe.
Uh-huh.
And a little trailer by it and went to Denver. And that I chose as the recession of 1938, which was no time to quit a job.
No.
And the only job I could get was at Climax, Colorado, Climax Millennium, which was then going great guns. So I got up there, and I was to be my informant underground there, and they had tested eyes at that time. They gave me a physical, but you couldn't go underground unless you were 20/20 uncorrected.
Ooh.
And I wasn't. I couldn't make it. So I went to work as a laborer in the mill, a cleanup gang, which was quite a come down. But I had to have a job, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I lived in the bachelor quarters up there, and then I wrote to USG to see if they had any openings, and they immediately hired me.
Hired you back?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Immediately, and I think they sensed why I left, you know,
mm-hmm.
and sent me up to Marcus, Washington, which is now underwater from that big dam. And they had purchased a lime plant up there, which was an industrial lime plant.
Lime.
Making a very high quality lime for paper industry and other industry. I was sent up as plant engineer to get some new kilns built and do some other things, and also to look at their deposit. They were having trouble with silica too high. So I went up there and spent a year there and told them that they had a really serious problem with their deposit. And when I was up there, they asked me to undertake some exploration work in Nevada, sent me down, and I was to go from the Utah border across the state of Nevada and across the Sierra, and I was to look for gypsum deposits on both sides of the railroads, the Southern Pacific and the Western Pacific, all across this stretch of country.
Mm-hmm.
And I did it, and it was a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
And I started to think.
You're all alone?
All alone.
Huh.
And I got all the information I could from the Nevada and California Bureau of Mines, and went to work, you know, looking up every reported occurrence and every piece of geology that looked like it might have any interest. And I found nothing more than is known today.
Mm-hmm.
That is, I found nothing new.
Mm.
But I spent 6 weeks and had a lot of fun.
That's a lot of country.
Back in that country, yeah. Well, I had to be within trucking distance of a railroad. I couldn't, for instance, look at all of northern Nevada. I had to think about what transportation if I, you know, to a railroad.
Yeah.
So I had some limitation. And that was an extremely interesting piece of work for young folks.
One question I wanted to ask you here, going back a little bit, you had said something about a community garden in Oklahoma.
Oh, that I was talking about the background of this plant during the Depression.
This is in Southern.
In Southern Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. When I got there in 1935, they did have some business, and the plant was functioning 5 days a week, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But earlier in the Depression, before I got there, business was almost non-existent.
Mm.
And they just didn't lay off everybody. They gave everybody a little work every week, you know, a day or two. But they formed a community garden.
Yeah.
And it was a great success and provided the people with food, a lot of which they could store over the winter.
Yeah.
And was a factor to getting this group of people through the Depression, when they were working so little.
Whose idea was this?
Well,
do you know?
That was the works manager.
Do you? Uh-huh.
His name was Allison, yeah.
Allison?
Merle, M-E-R-L-E, Allison, A-L-L-I-S-O-N.
Uh-huh.
Who was a very fine man, and I think he's the one that developed that plan.
Mm.
But it was very tough, and of course there was no place for those people to go.
No.
And he wasn't going to have them starve if he could help them.
Had these people come from Kentucky and Tennessee recently, or
well, they
been there
drifted
for
into Oklahoma? Yes, they.
For a long time.
You know, they hadn't come directly to this plant. They,
no.
They drifted west.
They hadn't come just because of the Depression.
No.
I guess
no,
is what I was asking, because the Oklahoma people went to California.
Yeah,
but
no, this was not that kind of a trip.
I see.
These people just happened to be working their way west. And,
I see. Uh-huh.
Out of the Appalachians.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I wanted to catch up on that. And then, so then you went, did this exploration work in Nevada. That was just during one summer? Or maybe not summer, that would be deadly hot in the summer.
I forget what it was. I think it was spring.
Uh-huh.
And Then I went back to the pilot Evans, Washington, which was on the Columbia River. Shortly after I had returned there, where I was the flight engineer, the Chicago office asked me to move down to Lovelock, Nevada, to head up a drilling program on a gypsum deposit at Lovelock, which of course I knew existed, I hadn't seen, and then got an option on it. And they had a consultant there named Jack Byron. And Jack was a mining engineer and a U.S. mineral surveyor. And he was on the site surveying the claims and doing that sort of thing. And I was to head up an actual exploration program, and the company sent in a new core drill and a driller, and I picked up local labor around Lovelock, and we went to work drilling out this deposit. The most interesting aspects of this was that
just when okay.
Was that Jack Byron really taught me how to survey, because I had never before been with a U.S. mineral surveyor. Surveying with the accuracy in which he had to survey.
Oh.
So he taught me techniques that that I hadn't been familiar with.
You hadn't had that in college?
Not in that kind
not
of detail.
Not that kind. Uh-huh.
Because I learned from a real expert.
Hmm.
And
when you say U.S. mineral surveyor, what?
Well, that's an official title. That means he's passed government tests.
I see.
And is licensed to survey claims for patent, which means it has to be very accurate surveying.
Mm-hmm.
My education picked up working for him.
Uh-huh.
Which I did for a while before our equipment got there. And then I was on the job there for, we drilled that thing and we mapped it and did all the usual things you did and sampled it and sent the samples off to another plant to be actually running the plant and so on. And the company bought the part of the deposit which they could get their hands on eventually, and eventually I bought for them a square mile of desert on which to build a plant in the future, and which they still own, I'm sure. But the deposit was not high grade and hasn't yet been worked. But we did a very thorough job of exploring it and working out some rather complex geologies you don't see very often in the industrial minerals field. Anyway,
what was complex about it?
Was folded and faulted.
Uh-huh.
Rather unusual matter.
Hmm.
And Then the company got an option on a property out of Yerington, Nevada, about 10 miles out of Yerington, Nevada, called the Reagan Quarry, which was supplying very pure gypsum to cement mills. And the company got an option on this property because Lovelock hadn't turned out as well as they do. And they asked me to pick up and move down there. And we moved in one day. We pulled out of Lovelock, and the next day we were drilling in Yerington. And we drilled that deposit. And
now this is diamond drilling?
Yeah, diamond core drilling. And and of course we started mapping and doing the usual things you do, and we discovered, much to our disappointment, that we had a little fault block. We first drilled all around it, we couldn't find anything. Then we went down into it, into the pit itself, which was being worked, and drilled holes out from the pit itself. And we found this was a little fault block all by itself.
Oh.
And that was my thesis for my professional degree, because the company dropped the option on the property, and I asked them if I could use it for my thesis, and did. And that's how I got my professional degree, was from that. And I took about 6 months. Then they sent me back to Lovelock to do some final surveying to survey a road from the deposit to the plant site, which was on the main line of the Southern Pacific, and I did all that sort of stuff. And then
this is getting up to be 1940.
This is 1940. And they sent me down to the biggest plant they had in the West, a place called Midland, California, 25 miles north of Blythe, out in the real desert.
No, I thought that was late.
Well, this is the first trip.
I see, okay.
There's another one that comes.
All right. Okay.
And they had a very complex geology down there, and they sent me down there to see what I could do to solve the problems of working that deposit. So I ran a core drill crew, and we did mapping. And
so you were really doing mainly geology at this point.
At this time, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm afraid I wasn't very helpful. And then, much to my surprise, I got word that I was appointed works manager for the Heath, Montana plant, which was a tremendous step forward for a young fella. And so I went up to Lewistown, Montana, which is the nearest big town, and picked up my mother somewhere. I forgot where I left her. my picture of him out near the coast of California, which I had found a place for. And we drove up to Montana, and I took over as manager of a small but quite interesting plant that served the Pacific Northwest with sheetrock and plaster and rock lath and standard building materials. And this was my next real learning period in management, because now I was in charge of the whole facility, the mine.
This was fabrication as well.
Yeah, this was the mine and the calcining mill and the board plant and shops and everything.
Ooh.
And it was a dandy job. It was a, we had a couple of interesting incidents there. One was that the mine caved in.
Mm.
This was an all underground mine. And when I first went there, I had been very concerned because the main entry from the plant back underground into the mine was being supported by pillars which had been robbed, very fragile pillars, but they'd been there forever, you know. And I couldn't really justify a program of going in there with concrete buttresses and so on. But it bothered me that this main entry was had been so, the pillars were so thin. Anyway, one night I was out picking wildflowers. The night shift went to work Sunday evening, and as I drove into town, and one of the entrances to town was one of the Heath employees, and he waved me down, and he said, "The mine is caving in."
Uh-oh.
They put somebody at every road that went into town to catch me.
Mm.
And so I went out there, and sure enough, it was caving in. And those thin pillars had given way, and we were totally blocked. Nobody was hurt because the crew going in Sunday evening heard the stuff coming down, you know, and backed out, and they and it was some night because that whole mine just collapsed.
Oh my.
It just unraveled, you know.
Mm.
And the good part of the mine, where we were doing proper mining with proper pillars and everything, was cut off, you know.
How large a mine was it?
Well, we only put out 400 tons a day. So it was a small mine, but kind of vital to the plant, because it's interesting that after you get through the process, you make as much wallboard in tonnage as you took in rock.
Do you?
But so we made about 400 tons of product a day. So I had the quandary what to do.
Mm.
And one of the interesting little vignettes is that the division manager who was my boss in Chicago was a man who liked to put on a very tough mien, you know. And so I called him that morning and informed him that we had lost the mine and had caved in. And instead of there being a big strutting uproar from the other side, there was a weak little voice that said, "Jack, what are you doing about it?" Well, they had driven an exploration at it into the side of a hill just about a half mile from the mine, and they had done a good job and left all the material in a good, neat dump. So I went to town and hired some trucks and hired some laborers, and we hand-loaded that stuff and trucked it around to the crusher, and we kept the plant going. We never lost a square foot of board.
Oh, my.
But then we had this, that was only good for, you know, a short length of time, relatively mm-hmm. speaking. So we decided to go around the side of the hill and on the edge of this deposit, getting a little rock as we went, and then started a new entrance that would take us into the good part of the mine that was not caved. All this was done.
You didn't try to reconstruct the cave part?
Oh, no, there was no chance at all there. That was gone. And we lost equipment. We lost mm-hmm. metal generator set and other, you know, good equipment. But that was never recovered.
You lost a what?
Motor generator set.
Motor generator.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And other equipment was gone.
But no people.
And the company sent out their veteran mining engineer, who was in his 70s, was the vice president and had been vice president of engineering, to help me. And he and I were fast friends and remained fast friends until he died.
What was his name?
John Knoll. And I've written stories about John Knoll. He was a remarkable man, and we really can't get into his life here, or we'll have another old biography. But anyway, we got that job done and got back into the good part of the mine and instituted different mining practices. And it had been hand loading. And I introduced slushers and designed the slushers and had them built. And
you made your own there?
Well, we had them made in Great Falls in a steel shop in Great Falls, two of them, and they were a great success, and the mine was mechanized finally.
Did the men resist this at all?
Oh, no. Oh, I was glad to get out of hand.
Uh-huh.
Oh, we had to teach them how to run these things, but I knew how to run them, and that was no problem.
Uh-huh.
So that was the mine incident.
What kind of mining you were doing?
Room and pillar.
Yeah. Mining. Uh-huh.
And they
just left pillars that were too small.
Well, they robbed them, you know.
Uh-huh.
I just don't understand it. But of course, the overburden above the entrance of the mine was rather light, but. It was always a worry to me, but looking back, I should have done something, but I don't believe I'd have been, I don't believe I would have been allocated a nickel to fix it because it had been standing for 20 years or more.
Yeah.
Anyway, that was one very interesting aspect of that job. The other interesting aspect was that my predecessor, who was a bright young guy that was moved on to other things, had started to speed up this board plant, which by any standard was a very small board plant. And when he went there, it had a line speed of 15 feet a minute. And he decided that it could be speeded up. And it started to do that work. The war had just about started. And the defense industry was in full blast. And our materials were badly needed. And we could sell every square foot we could make, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I got together, the head of the laboratory was a chemical engineer. And he and I sat down and talked about the theory of drying this board. And we decided that the theory had been all wrong and that dramatic increases were possible. And the theory was that you kept the temperature of the kiln below the theoretical scorching temperature of the paper on the manila paper, which is on the outside of sheetrock. You know.
The what kind of paper?
Manila paper.
Manila paper. You know. Okay.
You know, you've seen sheetrock; it's got a kind of a creamy surface.
Mm-hmm.
And we decided that as long as we were evaporating water from the surface of the board, that we could let the temperatures go way up. As long as we were evaporating water.
This is manufactured wet.
You know, it goes into a kiln, wet.
Wet. Mm-hmm.
It's formed wet and then goes mm-hmm. into the kiln, which is a long, long affair, you know,
mm-hmm.
6 or 8 decks high. So as long as water was evaporating off the surface of that board would not scorch, mm-hmm. regardless of what the temperature was. You know.
Mm-hmm.
And so we went to work on that process, and we kept speeding it up until we got it up to 45 feet a minute, or 3 times its design capacity. And first we had to keep changing motors, we had to keep adding, you know, more air, more hot air, and there was a lot of detail, engineering that went into it to make it work, you know. And, but of course the word got around and this revolutionized the manufacture of gypsum board.
Wow.
Increased everybody's capacity then, you know. Everybody.
You were doing something that nobody else had done.
They hadn't done it, though.
For heaven's sake.
This young fellow that was a works manager ahead of me had conceived of the idea, but he hadn't really developed the theory yet. He was on the right track. But this chemical engineer and I, simple, you know, but not obvious. Simple, but not obvious.
What was his name?
His name was Kaufman, Vern Kaufman. C-O-F-F-M-A-N.
Mm-hmm.
And He later succeeded me as works manager of the plant.
Huh.
But the result was tremendous increase in production, tripled. And all this stuff gave me a pretty good reputation in the company.
I would say so, yes.
Yeah. Well, while I was at Heath, I got a little alumni bulletin from St. Francis House, the Episcopal student house at the University of Wisconsin, which I had attended. And, you know, and I was confirmed there. And it said that Faith Hartley is in nurse's training at St. Luke's Hospital in Chicago. News notes, you know. And I thought, I know that girl. She was a friend of Sis at the Delta Gamma House. And I never would be interested in her seriously, and I can't remember her as ever being at St. Francis House, but she may have gone there after I left, for all I know, you know. Because it didn't put any date after. So I said, well, the next time in Chicago, I'll call her, because it would be fun to get together and talk about our mutual friends. And I knew that's all there'd be to it, you know.
Sis had gone off by this time?
Yeah, she was doing other things. We never got close to matrimony.
Uh-huh.
And I'm not quite sure why, but I never could pop the question. But we stayed friends until she died. We corresponded, and she later married.
Mm-hmm.
Had an unfortunate marriage. That's a book.
Yeah, well.
You know. Anyway. I had to periodically go to Chicago, which was the headquarters. So the next time I went, I called St. Luke's Hospital and asked for Faith Hartley, and I got her on the phone and told her who I was and to remember so-and-so, and it drew a complete blank. She didn't know me from at all. And so we started checking dates, and I discovered that she had started at Wisconsin 6 years after I had left. And I had the wrong girl for some reason or other. So I said, well, I was going to invite this friend of mine to dinner tonight. Why don't you come just for the fun of it? And she said, you know, my date has just stood me up. He's a reporter and he has to work tonight. I'll come. And I said, well, how will I know you? And this is getting hard for me to tell.
Yeah, I know.
She said, I'll just be average and I'll have a black coat. And I'll come through the lobby and meet in the lobby there. So I go into the lobby of St. Luke's Hospital, and here is a nursing student sitting there on the couch, gorgeous blonde with a black coat. And I thought, oh boy, how lucky can I get on a blind date, you know? So I go up to her and I ask her if she's Faith Hartley. And she says, no, but I wish I were. I was befuddled to say the least. And then on comes along the real one, and immediately I just fell for her.
She didn't realize.
Yeah. And took her to dinner. Took her at a place called the Cellar, which was quite a place in those days in Chicago. Then the next morning, I managed to wangle her to breakfast at the Palmer House.
Oh my!
Oh yeah, with the waiters in their dress suits and the busboys in their scarlet jackets and all that stuff, you know. And then that night, I was hitting the timing just right because she worked all kinds of hours, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that night, I invited her to one of the better, Henrici's, which was one of the better restaurants in Chicago. Proposed to her.
One day later.
Yeah, and she thought that was totally ridiculous, and she was interested in doing what she wanted to do, and what she was doing, and that was that, you know. I got on the train, went home. It took me a year to finally catch her.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, and then
a lot of coincidences had to get put together for that,
yes,
didn't
and,
they?
And I wrote to the house mother at the Delta Gamma House in Madison, and told her just that I had been trying to meet a girl that I had known. X years, you know, and I got the wrong girl, and had there been a Faith Hartley, she wrote back and said, yes, there was a Faith Hartley.
For heaven's sake.
And I didn't catch the difference in the name. That was too close. You know,
amazing
both in Wisconsin.
Coincidence, isn't
yeah
it?
Yeah. So.
Well,
anyway,
that sounds as if it was meant.
It's part of the Heath story because
meant to be.
This chasing was while I was at Heath, and I was finding more excuses to get back there, the Chicago office, and
mm-hmm
take Faith out for dates, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, when we were married, she came to Lewistown, and we lived there for a year.
So that's where you started out, was at the Heath?
Yeah, we lived in Lewistown. And she went in to finish her nurse's training in a very good little Catholic hospital in Lewistown, run by nuns, and they were delighted to have her. And
I'm sure they were.
And in fact, they just made her a full-time nurse.
That must have been quite a change for her, though.
Yeah.
Growing up in Los Angeles,
yeah,
and
she was
studying in Chicago.
Cold all year. She was cold in Lewistown. All summer. And all the rest of the year, she was cold.
She'd never lived in a small town before.
No, I don't think she had, but she never lived in that kind of climate. Of course, she lived in Madison, which is
cold.
Which can get plenty cold, but she hadn't lived in the dry cold that we had. The cold summers.
You said that her father was head of the music department at Occidental College.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And her mother, who was knocking on soon after her 101st birthday, was a singer of some note down in that area.
So she'd been used to a little more cultured environment than you find in some of these mining places.
Oh, yes, yes. But she was the kind of person that could be at home anywhere, you
yeah.
know. And we made good friends in Northtown. There were a lot of nice people. And that was a town
oh, yeah.
about 5,000 people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There were some interesting people there.
But not every city girl would think that it was.
No, and later on when we lived in mining camps, boy, she accepted it.
Uh-huh.
She could, one time we spent some time in the towers of the Waldorf Astoria on business, you know, and that was fine. She could accept that, and then she could accept living out in the desert.
Uh-huh.
Midland, but just, you know, just, she was a very flexible.
Very adaptable.
Person.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's great.
Always making friends.
Yeah, well, that's just great.